Arjuna Ardar with us as we're talking about his co-work with John Gray, Conscious Men. That's the latest work. So soon we will talk with him about how do you get into this mode of awakening and awareness when so many things have happened in our lives. And what I'd like you to do, in addition to your questions, is share that one story with us that was really so earth-shattering for you. I want to know how you pulled through it, if you did. Maybe you didn't. Okay, welcome back to Coast with Arjuna Ardar, and your phone calls as well, and your stories. And Arjuna, you were just about ready to tell us some of the techniques that you had put together to create that awareness and awakening. So I'll let you wrap that up, and we'll take some calls.
Yeah, and you know, actually, I was just hearing in the break, there was a little mention there of a catalog, and there you were saying you love to give away free stuff to your listeners. It's your greatest pleasure.
I do. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got some, so we've actually put together some free stuff exactly for Coast to Coast listeners. We've been developing a 5-day mini course, which is completely free. And it has, every day, it has not only some great tools, it also has a video of some of the men we interviewed, some of the most inspiring men we interviewed, including John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods, and Rob Albee, who has been doing incredible work with men in prison. So if you go to consciousmen.com, it's very easy to remember, consciousmen.com, there's a little box there. You can just put your name and email, and we'll get out 5 days of free material about what we've been writing about in the book, including tips that you can use right away to explore this in your life.
Excellent. Is it difficult for people to get into that groove?
It's not difficult. It's just not habitual. You know, we just have to learn some new tricks. You know, I mean, nothing's really difficult. If you know where to find the key, then the door opens quite smoothly and easily. So we just have to understand what is required to get the result we want. A little example we just discussed before the break was about taking space. It's not difficult. It's not actually difficult to sit in a chair and close your eyes for a few minutes and regroup. It's not difficult to do that. It's easier than doing stuff. It's just not habitual. It's not our habit necessarily to remember to slow down. It's another thing we talk about a lot in the book is listening. It's a very key ingredient to a man becoming a great leader, as well as a great husband and a great father, is developing the capacity to listen. Now, it's not difficult to listen. It's actually easier to listen than to speak. But we have to be reminded of how easy it is. And that's really what we've been doing, is really developing just simple ways to remind people of what works, to remind people of how easily the key can slip into the lock, and you can open the door to feeling good about yourself again.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to Vancouver, British Columbia. Lynn is with us. Hey, Lynn, thanks for calling.
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call, George. And your guest is just, I'm so glad this book is out there, because that whole section that you're talking about, taking space, I'd like to speak to that for a second.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll just make a historic reference to ancient Delphi, where they say the motto is "Know thyself." Mm-hmm. The paradox, of course, being that the oracle also there was a woman. Now, I'll fast forward quite a few centuries to Virginia Woolf, who's, you know, the only Virginia Woolf I really know is from an academic friend that asked me to type out one of her essays. But it was Virginia Woolf, and she spoke to a room of one's own. And at the time, it was, you know, it was for women, because it was also at a time where women wanted to start breaking out of the mold, if you will. And I'm not enough of an aficionado about Virginia Woolf to carry on. But as a young lady growing up, I had a little brother. And I totally got this idea of taking space, whether you're a man or a woman, because I had one of those terrorist-type little brothers. Hmm. And I think any young woman out there that has had one or more little brothers knows of what I speak. So I love this idea that you have to have that personal space, whether you're building models or doing woodwork or sharpening your skates or, you know, just hanging out with your own soccer ball in the garage. I don't, you know, reading your Louis L'Amours. You really need that space. And I've actually been the one that have told many of my male friends who, you know, with women being busy, sometimes they get cloying on their men because people don't see as much of each other person to person anymore. And I think we miss each other's pheromones in that regard, but that's another topic. But, you know, I told them this concept from Virginia Woolf to take the space. You need your space because, as your guest has pointed out, if you don't take that space, how do you get back the testosterone, you know? And you asked for one of those moments, George, and if I may, I'll just say I've had many of those moments, and I'm very single because I really need my space, because every time I've had one of those earth-shattering moments, one was a car accident, you know, and years later I heard on the radio a newscast, and I had planned to travel, but I couldn't because of the accident. And years later I hear of this, you know, criminal trial, and it turns out that there was a serial killer on the highway that I would have been cycling on had I not had the car accident. And I just get shivers right now just telling you about it again. You know, it was just one of those things. And of course, after a car accident, you really do learn how to take your space. I call them spiritual breaks. You know, if you're laid up convalescing from anything, there's a moment where you get to start the hobby or get back to the hobby or again, find out and know thyself. And thank you so much for all your work. And I'll take whatever comments you have off the air.
Okay, very good. Any thoughts on that, Arjuna?
Well, it was nice to hear someone so literarily astute. You know, it's not too many people who mentioned Virginia Woolf's name. I actually went to Cambridge University there, where she was there for a while. Not when I was there, but beautiful. I think one thing, you know, I'd like to emphasize about what you just spoke is that we are talking about masculinity and femininity, not just about men and women. So actually men of course have masculine energy. That's why the word men and masculine are often associated, but men also have some feminine energy which they can access, and equally women have not only feminine energy but also masculine. So in the way you were describing, although the need to withdraw is actually more associated with the masculine because of the hormones, so also the need to connect and to feel bonding, which is associated with oxytocin, which is more feminine, is equally can be important to men as well. So we have to find our balance. And I think it's important, you know, not to get formulaic about this, not to develop some rigid idea of men should be like this, women should be like that, but just to have an understanding of our biology so we can find the right mixture of masculine and feminine energy within ourselves.
Some government agencies are recommending that everyone undergoes psychological exams. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I remember
everybody.
I remember when I was young. You know, the reason I got into all this stuff, the reason I pursued any of this, was really just suffering. I was born into a fairly dysfunctional family in London, and I needed help. You know, I was a teenager and I needed to get some help. So I remember actually going to see a psychologist at one point when I was a teenager because I was in trouble. And I can remember coming to the conclusion, even in my teens, that the psychologist seemed to need as much help as their patients did. You know? So I don't know if everybody needs a psychological exam, but I definitely think everybody needs to have ways to take care of themselves. You know, everybody needs to find ways to reconnect with their essence. The problem with a psychological exam is it can so often be a way of pathologizing us. You know, psychology is really the whole current wave of psychology. The grandfather was Sigmund Freud, who was busy pathologizing, busy interpreting things in terms of pathology. And I prefer to understand things in terms of health. and to understand how we can come back to our goodness and come back to how we feel good. And so really the essence of health from the masculine in all of us, in men and women, from the masculine has to do with withdrawal, space, silence, stillness, centeredness. The essence of health for the feminine in all of us, whether a man or a woman, has to do with connection, love, empathy, bonding. So through a balance of those two, we can find our own center again. Rather than having the government conduct psychological tests, I'd rather encourage people to bond with each other and to bond with themselves and to rediscover their natural health, their natural wellness, natural goodness.
Do you think people generally are good people and that they want to continue to be good?
I do. I really do. I've got to tell you, call me a fool, but I really do. You know, I really do. I really do feel that. And it's partly from coaching that sometimes I coach people who've lost their way and who've become angry and bitter and even who've become destructive. But if you dig deep down and listen carefully and help people to feel the feelings they've not wanted to feel, and to face the things they've not wanted to face, and to forgive the people they've not wanted to forgive, I really do feel, George, that that human beings actually are essentially good. Not everybody agrees, but that's what I've discovered. Well, and I'm curious to know, what do you think about that? Do you think that people are essentially good?
I think so. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. But there's a lot of evil, too.
Yeah, but is somebody, when we see somebody as evil, is it somebody who's behaving in an evil way? Or could that, is there actually the possibility that somebody is intrinsically evil? It's a very, very kind of
know if somebody's intrinsically evil. I don't know if they're born that way. I think they develop that way.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
First time caller, Kim in Austin, Texas. Hi, Kim. You're on with us. Go ahead.
Good morning, George and Juno.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
I would say I have been up in life and down in life, probably more down in the past 6 months or so. And I've noticed, you know, from 50-some years of life that these cycles of physical, spiritual, financial, emotional seem to run in waves. Mm-hmm. That sometimes we're up, sometimes we're down. And when you're down, it's hard to find that key, as he was saying. To unlock that lock.
What were some of the events that got you down?
That I've lost a lot of loved ones in my life.
Ah.
From the time I was young, I lost a brother in an airplane accident, lost many friends in car wrecks, drugs, car wrecks.
Almost like one after another, I bet.
Yes, and it still continues where I hardly know anyone anymore.
Jeez. Okay.
Most of my friends were gone. Cancer. My mother, cancer, one of my best friends from a childhood, died last year of cancer.
How do you pull yourself out of that, Arjuna?
Well,
not easy.
Not easy. First of all, you know, Kim, I want to just extend my heart to you. I know how that can be, and I think it's important to allow yourself to feel your sadness and to allow yourself to recognize that that's the natural way to feel. When I hear you speak, and I could hear a little tremor in your voice as you spoke of losing loved ones, I feel for you. I feel for you, and that's the natural response to have, to feel sadness about that. I know that for myself and for the people that I work with and that I help, sometimes there's this principle that we could call, I label it as give what you hope to receive. You know, give what you hope to receive. So I would imagine if you've lost people in your life, what you hope to receive is solace. What you hope to receive perhaps is new connections. And sometimes the way to get what you long for is to give it. You know, so if you've actually, ironically, if you've lost people, maybe the thing is to find ways to offer solace to others who have lost people. I've certainly found that when we can reach out and help others who are suffering in the same way that we are suffering, you actually, miraculously, you kind of become the solution. You know, if you seek to be consoled, offer
consolant. If you seek to be, if you seek to feel a sense of community, offer a sense of community. And I could feel from your voice, Kim, I could feel the sadness that of your losing people, but I could also feel your heart in that. And your heart may be hurting from that loss, but your heart is also an instrument of giving. So my hope for you is that you'll find a way to reach out and help others who have suffered in the same way. And then all that suffering actually becomes of some use, because the suffering you've experienced becomes a way to help other people. I've suffered a lot in my life. I mean, obviously, you know, people have died, but I've suffered in other ways too. I've suffered from financial loss. I've suffered from having a difficult family at the beginning. But all of those things actually became to my benefit when I started to help other people. They became the vehicle of compassion. So I hope for you that you'll find a way to give what you hope to receive.
Ethan's in Minneapolis now. Ethan, thanks for calling. Go ahead. Ethan? Ah, we're on a delay, and he probably ran away from his radio for a little bit.
Okay.
Let's go to Mike in Montreal, though, on the international line. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Thanks a lot, George.
Sure thing.
Haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah. Good to have you.
Yeah. I have an interesting example of the power of the conscious mind and the power of decision, I guess. I think far more than we realize, we really are the generators of the world around us and the circumstances that we're in. When I was fairly young, I promised myself I'd be a millionaire by the time I was 30. And I was. And I did it by, people would say, ridiculous means. Everybody says I'm incredibly lucky, but it had nothing to do with that. I had decided what I was going to do. I was really interested in electronics and stereo. I put myself through university selling high-end stereo equipment. Just loved it. Still a hobbyist. And I got to one point where I was tired of working for other people. I decided I'm going to open my own stereo store. I only had $73 in the bank.
Good for you.
But I told everybody around me that I was going to do it. I decided to do it. I started doing research at the library into where the disposable income was the highest and blah, 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 where I should open my store. I then started calling real estate agents, making appointments to go out and see all sorts of different locations. Still only had $71. No, I had $51 by then. And then a friend I'd worked with in the stereo business came over to my place and said, hey, I just got a big commission check. I hear you're opening a store. I'd like to go with you. I can give you $5,000 if you want to put me in. All of a sudden, we had the airfare to get to where I was going. And it went on and on like that. I would sit around in an executive lounge and talk to different people about what I was doing, and they would start begging me to invest in my company. Please, let me come in for $100,000. Let me come in for $200,000. I had more money offered me than I could ever have needed. And then my girlfriend's mother called me up and said, I just sold my house. I'd like to send you all the money to open your store.
Jeez.
So I ended up being a partner. I made millions of dollars.
Mike, that's the way to do it, my friend. But it's not all about money, is it, Arjuna? Let's talk about that when we come back. We're going to come back and take some final phone calls with Arjuna Arda as we talk about conscious men, and most of the callers are men. Few ladies, though, and I appreciate that, too. Okay, back with our final segment with Arjuna Arda, and you've heard what we've been talking about all night, of course. Arjuna, but money is not everything, is it? That doesn't necessarily make you happy. I know a lot of people with a lot of money, and they're not happy.
Right. You know, there's been some fascinating research done in the last couple of decades, I'm sure you're aware of, George. I think the most interesting is Martin Seligman's work at Penn State, where at the Center for Positive Psychology, they've really been able to measure quite accurately the significant markers of well-being. You can determine somebody's well-being with things like divorce rate, stress levels, drug addiction, and so on. So they came up with 22 markers of well-being, and they discovered the relationship between well-being and money actually operates on a bell curve. So if you're making, say, $30,000 a year, and your income goes up to $35,000, your well-being will actually increase, but it levels off at something around between $90,000 and $100,000 in America. It's less than that in England because of nationalized healthcare, but in this country, it levels off at between $90,000 and $100,000. Then it levels off for a while, so it doesn't make any difference. But here's the thing you'd never expect. The shocking news is that at a certain point, it actually goes down. In other words, somebody making $200,000 a year, if their income goes up to $250,000 a year, according to these 22 markers, their well-being will actually decrease. In other words, the likelihood of drug addiction, of stress, of various other things is going to increase. So that's an awesome statistic. And in the same period that this research has been going on, we've had people like Sean Penn, Russell Brand, many other celebrities have been stepping forward and saying, you know, it wasn't worth it. The fame and the money, it just was the booby prize. And actually, we discover that what really makes a difference is what we've been talking about all night, which is rediscovering that very difficult to describe sense of being a good person and leading a good life. And that's, I think, really what we need to be aiming for is money is, it can be somewhat the booby prize. You certainly need money to be able to operate in the world.
Well, you need enough to be happy.
You do.
That's what you need.
You need
enough. Pay your bills, do some things you want to do, but you need to be happy first. You got to be happy within yourself.
You need enough money to be able to do what you were born to do. You need enough money to be able to express your goodness. Like, you need enough money to be able to do what you do with your radio show.
Sure.
And through that, you're able to serve people.
I wonder if broke, homeless people are internally happy.
I'm sure.
An interesting take, huh?
I'm sure many of them are not. So that's where the logic doubles back on itself. We can't say that poverty is the key to happiness any more than infinite riches are the key to happiness. I think we need to look for the key to happiness, not in any kind of financial measurement at all, but in returning to yourself and in discovering who you are as somebody who has something to contribute. Like we were talking, remember, to, I think his name was Mike, who had lost a lot of loved ones. My hope for Mike is that he will find his way to give a gift. And when you discover the gift you have to give, all of the hardships you've passed through tend to fall into place. That's been my experience.
Yep. And time heals things, too.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Fairbanks, Alaska. Yorgi's with us, west of the Rockies. Hello there, Yorgi.
Hello. I'd like to talk about something that makes me happy in life.
All right.
I've had a lot of calamity. People die. But vodka kind of help, but in moderation, before two bottles.
Well, you got to be very careful with that. Two bottles of vodka. That's not the smartest thing to do, is it? I don't think so, Arjuna. Arjuna?
Well, I don't know.
Are you with us there?
Yeah. Are you asking me or are you asking Yogi?
Yogi is with his vodka.
Oh, he's with his vodka. Yeah, well, you know, alcohol is an interesting thing. A good friend of mine, Jack Canfield, I think you know him. He wrote Chicken Soup for the Soul. And
yeah, he's been on.
Yeah, he came out with an interesting book just last week. He came out with a book called The 30-Day Sobriety Plan. And Jack has been a social drinker for most of his life. He's 71 now. And he's recently actually experimenting with just going completely off alcohol and seeing what happens to his brain and to his body. So it's a very interesting book. It's a 30-day sobriety plan. It's his latest book, and it's very, very interesting insights in that book about social drinking as well as the dangers of addiction.
Okay, now we have Bob in Veneta, Oregon. Hey, Bob, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, George. And Arjuna, thank you very much. I think this is a very special subject, especially in our time in the world right now. And I just wanted to say and ask a question.
Sure.
I've been married for 34 years, and I have five children,
well, good
and two
for
of
you.
Them are boys. And I have used the whole time raising my children, I've practiced my Catholic faith, and I go to the Trident Mass, similar to you, George, I believe.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I've had a book of rules. There's a book called My Catholic Faith, and there's rules in there that tell me my rules as a man, my civic duties, my duties to my parents, my duties to my children, their duties back to me. And I was wondering, Arjuna, if you might think that maybe men have lost the rules what it is to be a man.
I think absolutely that's true, Bob. You know, and this is my feeling about rules. You know, that sometimes having a book of rules or a book of guidance, like the Ten Commandments, you know, that can be a great thing. But you know, rules get written down at some point from a source that comes from within someone. Sometimes that someone is a prophet. Sometimes that someone is a wise person. I think we're entering a time now, Bob, where we can use whatever means you have, including your faith in Catholicism. You can use that to bring you deeper to yourself, to your essence, where you can discover the rules that are intrinsic to you. You know, so for example, there might be a rule you could read in a book about your duties. But the difficulty with our time today, the time in which we live, is everything's so up in the air. So a rule that might have been very, very true 100 years ago or 50 years ago, we may not even have the circumstances the same for that rule to still apply. So I think it's really important to stay connected for you as a man with the source from which those rules came. And like that, you can discover your sense of what's the right thing to do in a world that's very rapidly changing. And the way to do that, of course, the way to do that is to use your religion to connect with your spirit. Use your religion. The word religion, the original meaning in Latin is religare, which means to bind you back to yourself. It's the meaning of religion, to bind you back to yourself, bind you back, so we can use your religious faith to bring you back to the source of religion, which is where actually rules are fresh and attuned to today, to the changing circumstances of today. My take on rules. What do you think about that, Bob?
Let's go to Miles now in Oak Harbor, Washington. Hey, Miles, thanks for holding.
Hey, George, this is an important show tonight, man. It's
sure
is. Listening in a long time.
Good.
I suffered a lot growing up, and I still haven't gotten over it yet. You there?
It's not easy. Is it?
Yeah.
No, it's just like, I'm 27 right now, and you said there's a lot of people that are good in this world. I haven't seen that much compassion towards me, you know. You know, my parents did well, but it just, growing up in it, it's hard, you know, nowadays.
Does it haunt you sometimes?
Yeah, I just can't. Like, when I see somebody treating bad in the past, my blood boils, and I can't get over it. I don't know what to do, you know.
Yeah.
I chew tobacco and listen to sad old country songs. That's about it.
Well, anything to help.
Yeah.
Anything to help. So if people read the book, Conscious Men, what are they going to get from it?
Well, a man like Miles, he's going to get a lot of tips on what he just spoke about. You know, he's really, what Miles, I think, was addressing is the challenge that we face with anger. You know, and anger, all men have anger. Men tend to be faced with a challenge of anger more than women because of different hormones in the body. Here's the problem with anger. You know, if you run with your anger, if you let anger take you over, it generally leads us to do things we later regret. Anger can be a destructive force. On the other hand, if we banish anger, if a man completely banishes anger and just refuses to ever feel it, he generally becomes a weak and submissive man, and he's not able to be effective in the world. So we need to find a way to feel anger, but to let it take us deeper into our power and our sense of authority and leadership. And that's actually something that we can use tools for. The key with anger is to be able to feel the essence of it without acting it out. If we can actually feel into the power underneath anger, that's actually like righteous anger. That's the anger that led the Master Jesus to overthrow the tables of the money changers in the temple. So we need to be able to find that place in ourselves which is righteous, which knows the right thing to do, and which is courageous. And that's the transformation of anger. And really, it's all about tools. It's all about really knowing how to work with energy skillfully, knowing how to take the raw materials of the life you were given and to transform it into something good. You know, and that's really what this is all about. You know, nobody had the perfect upbringing. You know, we've all of us been through difficult challenges. Either those challenges are going to overthrow you and push you down, or
those very things that could overthrow you become the very medium, the very building blocks of your greatness. So it's a matter of knowing how to use those circumstances. And I very much hope that John and I have put together some tools. Now, if you want to go to consciousmen.com, Miles, there is a 5-day little course there, and it includes a section on anger, including an interview with a man called Robert Albee, who went to prison for felony murder, you know, and was a heroin addict. But he managed to turn all that around, and now he's going into prisons and helping men to deal with their anger and to turn their lives around. So he's a really prime example of somebody who took very difficult circumstance, a very violent father, and turned it into a force for good. So we can all of us learn to do that.
Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin on our Skype line. John, let's get you in here. Go ahead.
Well, hello, George. Hello, Arjuna. How are you?
Good, John. Thank you.
Good, yeah. It's been a long time since I've called. In fact, last time I called, George, you were in Missouri back in 2008 waiting for your daughter to deliver her baby.
Wow.
And I actually made a prediction that you should stay there the remainder of the week because of the...
You were right.
Yes. Yes. And you were like, I will be there. But I digress. I'll tell quickly a story that kind of brought me into that awakened state. It was 1995. I was roughly 17 back then. And I had gone down to Florida to visit my grandfather, but then later that year, a couple days before Christmas Eve, he had passed away. And while I was in Florida, he and I argued almost constantly. And when he passed away, there was regret, but that was kind of when an awareness came in, and that's actually when I began to unexpectedly developed my abilities as a psychic reader at that time. You know, and there was a very deep, profound spiritual awakening. And I think back to the gentleman, Arjuna, that you talked with earlier in the hour, that, you know, he had lost all those loved ones, and how you suggested he should give solace, even when he doesn't have it himself. And so that's kind of one of the things I ended up doing over the years as well. But my question to you is, how do you stay in that wonderful awakened state when, you know, there's so much going on around you, perhaps maybe even in your own life, that can really drag you down? Or in my case, in my job as a reader, you know, where I deal with a lot of different energies, and some of it is not pleasant.
All right, let's get the answer. We've got 30 seconds left.
Okay. Well, I think you stay connected with that by recognizing that it can't go anywhere. You know, the clouds in the sky can come and go, but the sky itself doesn't move. So really what we're talking about is not actually a state. It's who you are. And it is there constantly. It's always there. No matter whether life is going well or badly, who you are is always there. If we get curious about your own true nature, that is the essence of awakening. And then we discover that which does not change.
Arjuna, thank you so much. Good luck with the work with you and Dr. John Gray, Conscious Men. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.